Welcome, everyone. Can people in the back hear me okay tonight? Okay, good. All right. Welcome to the survey of the Book of Isaiah class. Raise your hand if you do not have a lesson book. Okay. Who will help me pass them out? There you go, Daniel. Thank you very much. While Daniel's passing them out there, we'll go ahead and get started. As the title of the class says, this is a survey. That means that we're not going to be able to cover every verse, and we'll actually have to cover some chapters pretty briefly. If you've already studied your lesson tonight, you know we only cover the first chapter tonight, so that leaves 66 chapters to cover in 11 classes. There's only 12 classes for the first quarter because on March the 1st, March the 1st, our spring Bible series will be going on. So you can see that in this survey, we're going to have to cover about 6 chapters per night. There's some sections in the book that I'm going to spend less time on. And so there's a couple lessons. We're going to cover 9 chapters so that we can have some other lessons where we only cover 4 or 5. I hope that you will take the time to read all the chapters of each of the lessons. But I realize that not everybody is willing to spend that much time. And so what I'd ask you to do is, at a minimum, read the verses that I have attached to each of the questions. So you don't have to read as much, but you can still get enough to answer the question and come prepared to talk about it. I hope we'll have good class participation. That was the reason for moving everybody to the back half of the auditorium so that we can hear one another and participate in the class. I do have 2 special focus for our study of the book of Isaiah this time. And the first one is that I want us to look in depth at the verses in Isaiah that are quoted in the New Testament. Isaiah is the second most quoted Old Testament book in the New Testament. Psalms is the most. But anyway, there's 34 of them in Isaiah that is quoted in the New Testament. And so we're going to include, though, a study of those. I want us to look at what did it mean to the people of the day that Isaiah was living, and then how is it used in the New Testament context? So we'll have 2 aspects of each of the quotations. 2 of the 12 lessons do not have any quotes. I bring the quotes in when we're covering the chapters in which those quotations are taken from. So 2 of the lessons, we won't have any quotes at all. Other ones will have several quotes in each of the lessons. The second focus that I'd like for us to have is to develop each of us on our own a list of descriptions of God. If you look at the very last sheet in your lesson book, there is a blank sheet there with a bunch of lines. And so as you're studying through, I want to ask you to write down a description of God that you observe there. I think we'll find in the book a rich treasure of descriptions of God that I hope that by looking at that, it will help us to increase our respect and our reverence for God. About that last item there, you're going to have to remember to do that on your own. I forgot when I developed the lesson sheets to put a prompt in each lesson to remind you to do that. So you're going to have to remind yourself to pull out your description sheet and write in any descriptions. So that was a breakdown on my part there. Does anyone have any questions about the format of how we're going to do things here in the class this quarter? Yeah. Okay. All right. Ran out of books. Okay. So raise your hand so I know how many more to make here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Okay. All right. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Very good. Very good. So maybe you'll have your lesson book before you leave tonight. We'll see. It takes a lot of time with the two-sided sheets and everything. So let's get into our study tonight. Because this is a survey class, I decided that we ought to take look at an overview. And so there, right behind lesson one in your book is an overview of the book of Isaiah. I just copied this, didn't literally copy it, but I typed it from Homer Haley's book entitled, what's the title? A Commentary on Isaiah with Emphasis on the Messianic Hope. And so I'd like for us just to read through it together at this time. Within his own kingdom, Isaiah saw the results of apostasy from God, political, moral, and social decay. He saw Assyria, a nation from afar, as the instrument in God's hand to chasten his people in an attempt to save a remnant. Isaiah opened his prophecy with a description of Judah's apostasy, God's call to come reason together in his offer to pardon, chapter 1. This was followed by a vision of the latter days in which God's ideal for his city of Zion would be realized, chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Immediately drawn back to the present condition in Judah, the prophet denounced the ungodly rulers and judges, the false prophets, and the wanton women who contributed their part to the immorality of the nation, chapter 2, verse 5 through chapter 4, verse 1. But it would not always be this way. Through the purging effects of judgment, God would eventually have a purified remnant who would rejoice in him, chapter 4, verses 2 through 6. Isaiah then proceeded to pronounce woes upon various segments of society and to warn of impending judgment, chapter 5. At this point, we read that upon the death of Uzziah, the prophet received his call from Jehovah to carry God's message of doom and hope to the people, chapter 6. In light of failure on the part of the kings who ruled over God's people, Isaiah announces that the Lord will raise up a king who will rule in righteousness. This becomes the major theme of Isaiah, chapters 7 through 12. The king will be born of a virgin assigned to the house of David, chapter 7. This event will be preceded by the scourge of the Assyrians, chapter 8. Bringing darkness to Israel. But eventually those who sit in darkness will see light, the light of a new king, kingdom, and glory. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. Severe judgments are then pronounced upon Ephraim and Judah. Chapter 9, verse 8 through chapter 10, verse 4. These are followed by the announcement that Assyria will invade the land and in turn be destroyed. Chapter 10, verses 5 through 34. The prophet reaches a climax with prophecies of the coming of the branch from Jesse's roots and his rule, chapter 11, and a song of thanksgiving, chapter 12. Before the coming of this spiritual king and his kingdom, all the heathen nations of that time, from the greatest to the least, must be judged and brought to an end, chapters 13 through 23. With their destruction, the kingdom of God will stand out all the more glorious. This proclamation of the judgment of the heathen nations is followed by a prophecy of world judgment. Jehovah is again revealed as a judge of the nations and especially the great world city, which would be left a waste and desolation. This foreshadows the fall of Babylon of Revelation chapter 17 and 18. In this world judgment, Jehovah will protect those who put their trust in him, chapters 24 through 27. Ephraim, Judah, and Jerusalem are given more warnings and threats from Jehovah, with special emphasis on the danger of alliances with Egypt. There is assurance, however, of Jehovah's eventual gracious reign over his people, chapters 28 through 33. The futures of Edom, symbol of the world, and of Zion, symbol of spiritual people, are then contrasted, chapters 34 and 35. The first of the two major parts of Isaiah closes with a historical section. Divine intervention thwarts a serious effort to take Jerusalem. Faith wins the battle. This is followed by an account of Hezekiah's sickness and recovery, and his showing of the treasures of the kingdom to Merodach-Baladan's messengers, whereupon Jehovah pronounces that Judah will be carried off to Babylon, chapters 36 through 39. With victory over Assyria, the assurance by Jehovah of a Babylonian captivity at some future date, the prophet's work now was to prepare the people for that captivity and assure them of the return of a remnant. The second major part of the book is the record of this phase of Isaiah's work. The prophet entered into an all-out war against the idols, setting forth the Lord as sole deity, chapters 40 through 48. He named Cyrus as the deliverer, whom God would raise up, chapter 44, verse 28 through 45, verse 7. Amid words of encouragement, assurances of deliverance, indications of inclusion of the Gentiles in God's plan, and songs of the Messiah servant who was to come, Isaiah gave warning as to the consequences of further sins against Jehovah. With the coming of the servant, there would also appear his glorious kingdom, which would extend far beyond the borders of the former, chapters 49 through 57. Again, the glorified Zion is described and salvation is assured. The old order would pass and there would be new heavens and a new earth where, after a complete victory, the saints would behold the dead bodies of their enemies, chapters 58 through 66. Brother Haley also, in his book, had a description about Isaiah, the man, that I thought was quite good. Isaiah, a man of strong character, deep faith in God, courage and conviction, was the man of the hour whom the Lord selected to carry the torch of truth in the midst of spiritual darkness. Able to deal with any class, Isaiah was effective in court circles, among false religious leaders, and among the common people. One final introduction here that I want to cover before we get into our lesson tonight is Jim McQuiggan has a commentary called The Book of Isaiah, and he has some advice that I think is good for us to think about and remember as we study the book of Isaiah. Number one, we must gain a good knowledge of the world the prophet lived in. Number two, we must be prepared for the prophet's disregard at times for chronological progression. Old Testament prophetic books are not always in sequential order. So that's something for us to remember. It applies in part of the book of Isaiah. So you remember, not necessarily does everything go in chronological order like we would typically write today. Number three, we must be prepared for the sometimes confusing ways in which the speaker changes from one person to another. Sometimes God is speaking, and then without warning, someone else is speaking, like the prophet or the nation or enemies. Number four, we must be prepared for a sometimes confusing change of whom is being addressed. In one verse, the prophet may be addressing God, and before the verse is through, he is addressing the nation. I think you're going to find this to be a challenging part of the study of Isaiah. This happens quite often, and so you have to remember number four. And finally, number five, it is not always easy to strike a balance between letting the prophet speak in and to Old Testament times and letting him speak truths related to New Testament times. We must not make everything fit within the historical context, but neither should we make everything messianic. All right, let's get into tonight's lessons questions. First question is, who were the kings of Judah during the time of Isaiah's prophecies? And now it's time for all of you to start speaking up. Bill? All right. Bill got them there. They're right in there. The first verse of the book. Isaiah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. In chapter 6, verse 1, which we'll study, the Lord willing, next week, we'll find that Isaiah began his prophecy in the last year of Uzziah's reign. And tonight we'll get to the fact that Jotham was co-reigning with Uzziah during the last part of Uzziah's reign. All right, let's go on to, some more information there. Isaiah prophesied from 739 BC to 690 BC. According to tradition, Isaiah was executed by order of the king of Messiah. I'm sorry, Manasseh, not Messiah. Manasseh, King Manasseh. He was the son of King Hezekiah. So the book doesn't say that Isaiah prophesied during the time of Messiah. So indication is he probably was executed by Manasseh pretty shortly after Manasseh took took the kingship. Those of you who already know about Messiah, I keep saying Messiah, Manasseh, he was a very evil king, did a lot of things against God's will. So apparently that happened very quickly. And apparently Isaiah bore the brunt of that and was executed. One of the apocryphal writers wrote that Isaiah died by being sawn in two. That's mentioned, that way of death is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 37, which is considered by many to be a reference to Isaiah's death. Other prophets of the Old Testament who were contemporary with Isaiah was Micah, who also spoke primarily to Judah, and also Hosea and Amos, who spoke primarily to Israel. Anybody have a comment or question about anything we've covered? All right, let's go on to question number two. What was the spiritual condition of Judah during the time of those kings, the ones that that Bill mentioned there? This is a real general question. You could write quite a bit on this. Seesaw, all right. Victor says seesaw. How in that way, Victor?
Serving God, trying to serve God at least, not serving God, going back to serving God.
Okay, all right, very good. That's right. Anybody else want to say something? He said seesaw, serving God, not serving God, serving God. That's a general way of what was going on in the nation at that time. Anybody want to add more? Speak up a little bit, please, Harold. A time of prosperity. Okay. All right. Good. Good. Mark?
The wickedness is oftentimes attributed first to the leaders, and then the people follow the leaders, and then Hezekiah becomes a good leader, the people follow him for a while.
Okay. All right. All right. Mark's pointing out that that the leaders were following God or obeying God, the people would follow along, and the people followed along when the king went against the way of God. Okay. Anybody else have a comment? All right, let's see here. I put down some specifics here out of the text. I got the right slide. Uzziah was a king who did right in the sight of God, but you remember he had a flaw that developed during his reign. Anybody remember what happened to Uzziah towards the end of his reign? Mark? Okay, that's right. So, repeating what Mark said there, Uzziah decided to go into the temple and to do what only the priests were authorized by God to do. And when the priest confronted him, he didn't immediately repent. In fact, he kind of bowed up and said he was going to do it anyway. And so the Lord struck him with leprosy. And so the rest of his reign, he lived as a leper, which you know in the Bible times, that meant he had to live off by himself. And that's why Jotham, his son, was co-regent with him. And so that was the other thing is that in what I put there on the slide is that even though he was doing what was right in the sight of God, the Bible tells us that the people were still offering sacrifices in the high places. So they still were not totally faithful to God. Jotham, then, he reigned from 750 to 734. So we had Isaiah starting his prophecy in 739. And so for the first 5 years that Isaiah was prophesying, the king was Jotham. And Jotham did what was right in God's sight, but the Bible tells us the people continued to sacrifice on the high places. So somebody tell me a little specifics that you observed about Ahaz, King Ahaz, the next king. Anybody remember something about him?
Made his son pass with fire according to all the nations and nations.
Okay, Barb said that he participated, followed the what was the term you used there?
According to the abominations of the nations.
Okay, all right, that's right. So he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. We note that all of the kings. Okay, if you need a lesson book, Aaron's got some copies there. Raise your hand so he'll know who to give it to. There. Thank you, Aaron. So he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. The kings of Israel all followed idolatry, and the Bible tells us he even sacrificed his children to the idols. Second Chronicles chapter 28, verses 5 through 8, records that God delivered Ahaz into the hand of the king of Syria, who carried away a multitude of captives. And after that bad news, then the king of Israel attacks Judah, and he killed 120,000 men and carried away captive 200,000 women, sons, and daughters. So if you just kind of start to think about that, you say, wow, things were really going bad during that time. In fact, it's recorded in 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verses 19 and 22. For the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had encouraged moral decline in Judah and had been continually unfaithful to the Lord. Now in the time of his distress, King Ahaz became increasingly unfaithful to the Lord. And so this would have been a difficult time for a prophet of God like Isaiah to deal with a king that was so corrupt and led the people to be corrupt. The next king was Hezekiah. So somebody talk to me a little bit, some specifics you remember about King Hezekiah. Say it again, Harold. All right. He clears out the temple. All right. Good. Anybody else remember something about Hezekiah? Okay. Well, he did what was right in the sight of God, like he was likened to King David. And he removed the high places, broke down the idol images. 2 Kings 18:5 describes Hezekiah as trusting in the Lord, so there was none like him. So it's a high recommendation or commendation of Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles chapters 29 and 30 records the part of that Harold mentioned. He cleansed the temple, he restored worship, and he led Judah in keeping the Passover, such that it had not been done since King Solomon. So think about that. This is somewhere close, getting close to 300 years since the time of Solomon. They hadn't had a Passover observance like this since that time. So Hezekiah was an outstanding king in serving God. And in fact, a great renewal in Judah occurred, as recorded in 2 Chronicles 31, verse 1. Now when all this was finished, talking about the cleansing of the temple, the restoring the worship and the observance of that Passover, when this was all finished, all Israel who were present went out to the cities of Judah and broke the sacred pillars in pieces, cut down the wooden images, and threw down the high places and the altars from all Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh, until they had utterly destroyed them all. Then all the children of Israel returned to their own cities, every man to his possession. So we think of today the restoration movement. This is kind of like a restoration movement. They went back and they got rid of all of the idols things and went back to serving God. So this was a restoration here. To understand how serious the situation that Judah was facing at the time, I wanted to sidetrack here for a minute from our questions to look at the pressure that Judah was facing from threats from Assyria. Remember now that Isaiah prophesied from 739 to 690 BC, and during this period of time, four Assyrian invasions of the area occurred. Not of Judah itself, but all the areas around it. So the first invasion was in 734 BC. So it had been only like about 5 years after Isaiah started prophesying. And 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 29 tells us, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Ijon, Abel-Beth, Maacah, Genoa, Kedesh, Hazor, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. Now, if you're not familiar with the geography there, those seven areas that are mentioned and the tribe of Naphtali were all up in the northern part of Israel, of the nation of Israel. So think of the Sea of Galilee. If you think of that in the New Testament times, it was the areas up there. And so the king of Assyria conquered those areas and took the people captive. Then that would have been the time that Jotham was king in Judah at that time. The second invasion was in 722 BC. This is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 6. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king, that's king of Israel, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. So this is the time in which the nation of Israel completely dissolved, disappeared. This is the invasion that wiped out the nation of Israel. Hezekiah was the king in Judah at that time. So think about now. Let's actually look at, I got a map here. Let me see if I can get the pointer going here. So here we go. Down here, there's Jerusalem right there. So that's where we're talking about where Isaiah and Hezekiah and so forth would be. We see that the map is really large, so it's not very accurate here on, but you see that the northern part here, this purple lines are supposed to represent the deportation in 734 BC there. So they're taking the people from the northern area of Israel and taking them captive into the Assyrian empire. And then the second invasion is pictured here by the orange, reddish orange. I don't know exactly what color that is there, but you see that's the deportation by Shalmaneser and Sargon II in 724 to 729 BC. And so that's when 722 is when the nation of Israel completely fell and the people were taken into captivity. So that's what's going on. But now think about, what if you lived right down here in Jerusalem and all this is going on? I mean, this is like 70 miles away. What if today, if some country would come and conquer and completely overrun Lexington, trying to put it in kind of a relative area. We heard that Lexington has been completely conquered by the Chinese. How are we going to feel here? That's what we kind of need to think about, okay? So let's move on to the next invasion. The third one that happened while Isaiah was prophesying was in 711 BC. And this one is recorded in the book of Isaiah, chapter 20, verse 1. In the year that Tartan came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and took it. Now, if you are good at your Bible geography, you know that Ashdod was one of the five major cities of the Philistines, and they were just over on the, in between Judah and the Mediterranean. So now we're getting even closer here now, okay? And so they've come down and conquered Ashdod. And then the fourth and final invasion was in 701 BC. So again, still, Isaiah's prophesying. He's going to be prophesying until 690 BC. And this is recorded in 2 Kings 18, verse 13. In the fourth year of King Hezekiah, the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And so now it's not just other areas. It's part of Judah. We've got the fortified cities. So we've got the smaller cities, not Jerusalem. And we're going to study, when we get to chapters 36 and 37 of Isaiah, we'll study how that there was an attempt to take Jerusalem. But the Lord took care of Hezekiah and the people in the city. So here's one more map to look at. So what I want you to get out of this one is that this is Judah here pictured. Again, it's, you know, the scale can't be right because this is a huge area of the world. But anyway, here's Judah right here, and look at all around it, all the white around it. Judah has been completely surrounded by the Assyrians, okay? The Assyrians have taken every place around them. So how would you feel? That's what we need to think about and of the situation that Isaiah was dealing with. Okay, anybody have any questions? If you need a lesson book, we've got some more of them over here. Put your hand up if you got a lesson book. Okay, looks like we're taken care of, Andy. Thank you. Okay, let's go on to question number three. In chapter 1, God presents his case against Judah. And so what do you find as God's complaint in the verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1? They were revolting against him? I'm sorry, Pat. They didn't understand him. Okay, all right, very good. That's right. So they rebelled, even though he had nourished them and brought them up. Talks about how an animal knows its owner. So think of your pet dog. He recognizes you. It's being used to show how utterly just unbelievable it is that the people of God don't recognize him. Animals know their owner and know that they take care of them, and they show their affection to their owner. The people of Judah are not doing that. The word Israel here, you know, we pointed out earlier, Israel had been completely conquered. The word Israel here, I believe, is used in the sense of God's people. Sometimes that word Israel can mean specifically the northern nation, and sometimes it's used in a general way of talking about God's people. And I think here it's talking about God's people. So it's really talking about Judah, even though it uses the word Israel. Next part of the question was, what was God's complaint in verse 4 of chapter 1? I'm sorry. They were doing evil. Okay. Lots of evil there. That's right. They were sinful, laden with iniquity, evildoers, corruptors, had forsaken the Lord, provoked the Lord to anger, and turned away backwards. So all kinds of general ways of talking about all the evil that they did. And then we got one more question about God's complaint. What about verses 12 through 14? Okay. And what was wrong with the offerings there, Pat? Okay. All right. They weren't giving God the sacrifices that he wanted. And the problem was that they were hypocritical. They were going through the motions. They were going through the actions, but they weren't genuine about it. They weren't living consistent with it. So that was the complaint. And that is what I wanted to emphasize. The takeaway for, they were so hypocritical. They came into God's courts with sacrifices and incense, observed new moons and Sabbaths while continuing in their iniquity. And God could not endure it. And so that brings us to what I want to emphasize as the application to ourselves today. To think about what can we take away from this for our spiritual condition. So what lesson about worshiping God should we learn from verses 10 and 11 and 15 through 17 there in chapter 1? Bill? Okay.
Although you test them, you update times and seasons, but I'm afraid, in other words,
Okay, all right. Okay, all right. So Bill pointed out that they were doing things of their own, not by the will of God, teaching doctrines of men. So he had more to it than that, but that's all I can remember right now to say. So, okay.
Garrett? A couple of things that I get from this is we should learn to give God what God is asking of us.
Okay.
Not more or less.
Okay, give
God.
All right.
And also for us also to know to give our best to him because he is giving his best to us.
Okay, all right. So Garrett points out we need to give God what he asked us to give him in the way of of worship and to do it to our very best. Okay, Mark?
To that last point, the very best. That seems to be the condemnation God gives them. They're doing what God told them to do. They're offering sacrifices. They're observing all the things they're supposed to do. The problem is in verse 15, when you spread your hands out in prayer, I will refuse to look at you. Why? Because they're sinful. So I guess one of the things I take out of this is, yes, we need to be doing all the right things, but even if we're doing the right things, we're not doing the right things with the right heart. That's what he's getting at, that there's a heart issue within the people. They're going through all emotions. They're offering sacrifices.
Okay, very good. Wyatt?
Well, and the things that he's telling them they need to do extend beyond their worship. It's not just that their worship be proper, but they're telling them to seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. These are things well beyond. You know, it's easy for us to kind of separate in our lives, compartmentalize our lives. When we come here to worship, we're pure of heart and seek to do that, but we don't do the things we ought to do in our lives.
Okay, all right. Wyatt's pointing out that it's more than just worshiping God, it's treating our fellow man the way God teaches us to do. Treat them with justice and so forth. All right, go to Bill and then we'll come back to Garrett. Okay, doers and not hearers only. Garrett?
In the middle of these passages, I read quite often of God saying he no longer wants the sacrifice of the blood of bulls. He no longer wants the cattle and the lamb of the goat. I see that as God is saying, again, I want your best, but it's I want your sacrifice, not what is easy for you to give up.
Okay.
Give up the animal, I want you to give up yourself.
Okay.
So
all
we
right.
are to be our own sacrifice toward God, not just what we have possession of or what ties us to this world.
Okay. All right. Garrett, if you couldn't hear, Garrett was saying we need to sacrifice ourselves, give ourselves to the Lord. All right. Very good. Let's see here. Let's move on to... let's go on to question number 5. What is revealed about how God deals with mankind in verses 18 through 20?
He wants to bless us, but it's contingent upon our obedience.
Okay.
He's also a reasonable God.
Okay. All right. Victor brought up two things. One, he wants to bless us, but it's contingent upon us obeying. And then second, he appeals to our reason. Okay, very good. Anybody want to add to that? Mark?
It's not in those verses, but if you look at the first part, when did he rebuke them? Verse 4, when they're sinful, they're weighed down with sin, they're a brood of evildoers, they're depraved children, they've abandoned God. This shows us the patience of God. God doesn't bring the hammer down right away. He gives people time, but when he brings the hammer down, it's ready.
Okay.
What he extends to them is just this olive branch. I want to forgive you if you'll come back.
Right, good. Charles, you have something?
Yeah, close to that Mark's point there. It's a fear. It refers to mercy. You know, in that verse, you know, it says, come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. You know, it's almost as if taking his arm around us saying, look, yes, you messed up, and this is what could happen.
Okay, all right. Charles was saying that He sees here God's concern for the people. I'm sorry, Charles, you can correct me here if I didn't get it exact. But he's saying God was drawing the people to him. He wanted to be merciful to them, but they had to respond to that, right? They had to respond. Bob? Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Okay. Okay, very good. Okay. Okay, all right. For if you couldn't hear, Bob was pointing out that word reason there is not like, let's sit down and talk it out. It was instead saying, let's get this settled. You know what's going to happen if you do this, if you disobey, you're going to know what's going to happen. So thank you, Bob, for explaining that. All right, let's move on. Question number 6. What happens when men reject God? They just go farther and farther away from God. Sin leads to sin. So that's the point there. And because of time, we're going to skip on to, let's see here. I want to get to what descriptions of God did you note in chapter 1? I put a sample in that sheet there. The Holy One of Israel, that phrase or description of God is used 25 times in the book. Did you find any others as you were reading? The Lord of Hosts, okay, all right. The Lord of Hosts, that one is really used in the book of Isaiah. It appears 53 times in the book. And then the Mighty One of Israel, just 2 times. Those are the 3 that I found in chapter 1. Because of time, we'll just stop there. Look, what I want you to do, when you find these descriptions, I want you to kind of really meditate on what is that telling us about God. And I did that on the Lord of Hosts. And think about what we read in the Scripture about all the angels and all those beings when we studied the book of Revelation, those beings that were there in heaven, pictured in heaven. And think that the Lord is over all of that. He is the Lord over that. Talk about power. That's what we have in that picture. All right, let's go real quick. Let's move to the Isaiah 1 verse 9, which is the verse that's quoted from Isaiah in Romans chapter 9. That verse says, unless the Lord of hosts had left us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom and would have been made like Gomorrah. So what would that have meant to the people of Isaiah's day? Think about the context. What is it saying there? To those people, not to us, to those people. Okay. All right. So we've got all these complaints that God has, all the sins that the people have been involved in, and they're saying, you know, we are so rebellious against God. What we really deserve is the same thing that happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, when God just burned it up. That's what it's saying. That's what it would have meant to those folks, okay? Norman?
There needs to be an emphasis on God's mercy and grace as well.
Okay, because he had not done that, right? Okay, Norman was saying it points to God's mercy, his long suffering, because he had not done that to them. Okay, now let's come to Romans chapter 9 and verse 29. How does the Apostle Paul make use of this verse from Isaiah? Okay, all right. So, I'll real quick to save time. Romans chapter 9 begins with Paul's anguish that his countrymen, the Jewish people, have rejected Christ. It seems that some had said that the acceptance of the Gentiles meant God had gone back on his word regarding the Jews. But because of the sovereignty of God, no one can question God allowing Gentiles as well as Jews to be recipients of his mercy. Because this would be a crucial point, with the Jewish brethren, the apostle cites Hosea to show that God foretold of his acceptance of the Gentiles as his people. And then Paul cites Isaiah 10, 22 and 23 to remind them that God foretold that only a remnant of the Jews would be saved. And finally, he quotes Isaiah 1, 9 to point out that total elimination of the Jews from God's people was only avoided by a few righteous Jews. And so it is in the New Testament time, the Jews rejected Jesus. And the way in which the people were avoided that complete elimination is by serving God, by believing in Jesus. So, thank you for your participation tonight. Go ahead and do lesson 2 for next week, please.